as I trot up and down and read all these CVs and recognize how many of these books, excellent books, I've read. It's kind of, I'm feeling good. Anyway, it's my pleasure also now to introduce Jim Johnson. Holds his PhD from the University of Chicago and is a professor at Boston University. His first book, Listening in Paris, A Cultural History, won the Herbert Baxter Adams Prize and the Jacques Barzun Prize. His second book, His second book, Venice Incognito, Mask in the Serene Republic, won the George Mossy and Oscar Kincher book prizes. Jim.
Thank you, Jack. Hello, everyone. This is Madame de Merteuil writing in Les Liaisons Dangereuses. In order to succeed in the grand theater of society, one must join the intelligence of an author with the talent of an actor. The trope that called the whole world a stage was already somewhat shopworn, but in France it assumed new relevance in the 18th century. Cafes, salons, promenades, theaters turned everyday life into public performance. Strollers judged one another's taste by the cut and quality of fabrics. Conversation, however refined it might have been, had its winners and losers, with the triumphs or humiliations on display for all to see. Spectators at plays and operas watched with one eye on the stage and the other on the house in order to gauge their own responses in the reactions of the powerful. The Duc de Saint-Simon writes, "One never judges things by what they are, but by the people they concern." I'd like to share some thoughts today about the theater of everyday life in France before the Revolution, and I will do this necessarily by shorthand with a small number of writers that give us a glimpse of the psychology of this pervasive performance. The first insight comes from the early reign of Louis XIV. This is from the Duc de La Rochefoucauld, from his Reflections or Sentences and Moral Maxims. He wrote this when he was estranged from the court, discredited after the failed rebellion in the Fronde, decrepit with gout and failing eyesight and unremitting pain from his battle wounds. The maxims combine the crystalline elegance of French classicism with the cold precision of a pathologist. They are the age's most comprehensive catalog of human deceit, often delivered in single sentences. Sincerity is a ruse to win the trust of others. Chastity is the submission to necessity. Moral virtue is like improvised money in a city under siege. We honor the fiction by convention. The two most fundamental human traits for La Rochefoucauld are vanity and interest, which teach one to play, quote, every character in the Comédie humaine, end quote. One observation in particular helps us to understand the spectacle of everyday life. In a hierarchical society, that is to say a society of rank and deference, it is in the interest of each to accommodate the hypocrisy of the other. La Rochefoucauld. Humans would not live long in society if they were not the dupes of one another. This might be called willed mutual delusion. That is, the less powerful praises the more powerful as if he means it, and the more powerful hears the praise as if it's true. La Rochefoucauld claimed that his observations were universal, but we also discern his bitter experience of court society in them. One passage from Antoine de Courtin's Nouveau Traité de la Civilité is a good illustration of willed mutual delusion. It is around the central question in this book, how to preserve one's honor and still advance at court. It is not a matter of knowing whether one is speaking the truth each time one praises another. It is enough to believe one is doing so, and then it is not a lie. If we can persuade the person to whom we are speaking that we are ourselves persuaded of his merit, the compliment becomes sincere and obliging, even when the person knows in his heart that it is false. Obliging is the key word here. Such compliments confer a kindness and induce a debt. Roger Chartier and Jacques Revel have written of the diffusion of courtiers' manuals as models of civility throughout the 18th century in schools and colleges, in cities, and to the well-off commoners, in mass circulation projects targeting children. With the death of Louis XIV and the collapse of the precarious choreography of power, the dominant associations of politeness move toward hypocrisy. This is an example of the term civility from the Dictionnaire de Trévoux, published, as you know, throughout the 18th century. Quote, civility is certain jargon that men have established to hide the bad sentiments they have for one another. This widespread sentiment, nevertheless, did not prevent many non-nobles from making a show of politeness for the distinction they knew that it had carried. Nor did it prevent nobles from despising them for it and inventing new forms of politeness. By the middle of the century, a dominant figure for such falseness, falseness that was said to saturate the age, was the mask. And it appears in many discourses that go beyond politeness. Public words and emotions were described as masks. Friendship was a mask. The fluidity of dress that made reading rank impossible was a kind of mask. And in the manuscript by the Marquis de Mirabeau, L'Ami des Femmes, 1768, urbanity of civilization itself is, quote, a mask of virtue and not its true face. The spread of such views is due in part to the democratization of courtly forms of behavior, but I believe in a larger part due to the structure of insincerity in a hierarchical society. Commentators after La Rochefoucauld retained his view that the motivating elements of humans were vanity and interest. There are many good examples from mid-century. I'll talk about the playwright Marivaux. In his essays and in his journalism, Marivaux writes of the petit noble who swells like a toad in the presence of the grand noble. He writes about the way that a femme de qualité stiffens her posture and hardens her voice when she speaks to the lowborn. He writes about commoners who bow down before the highborn in the streets. He says they are not saluting the person but the privilege, and they bow while they are imagining themselves with that very privilege. He has an extraordinary tale called The Journey to the Truthful World. The narrator suddenly finds that instead of hearing words of other people, he's actually hearing their thoughts. His brain begins to translate their gestures and their tone of voice and their facial expressions, the subtlest cues of their bearing, and it's wildly disorienting to him because he sees friends whom he thought he knew and finds that they are unrecognizable. For example, at an elegant soiree, a 20-year-old tells a lady three times her age that her dress would look good on someone much younger. And the woman replies that one thing could tarnish this ravishing dress, and that is seeing it on an ugly 20-year-old. Another lady flatters the wife of a judge hearing a case that touches her family. This lady mocks this wife for believing her, and the wife contradicts her and says, the compliments are deserved, and I pledge to talk to my husband about this case. Marivaux's response to these small spectacles of insincerity were more typical of the age than Rousseau's outrage was. He urged a companionable toleration for the sake of community. Living together amiably does not require purity of heart. He writes, hypocrisy serves the general order of things. A man who loves virtue inspires 10 others who are not at all virtuous to act as if they were. And Nicolas Chamfort made a similar point, however, in a way that embraced the mutual interest that accrues from tolerating hypocrisy. He wrote, the difference between you and me, says Monsieur M., is that you say to all maskers, masque, je vous connais. I, by contrast, leave them with the hope of having fooled me. This is why society is better disposed to me than to you. It is a ball in which you have destroyed others' interests and your own pleasure. One way to frame the French Revolution is the sudden rejection, at least in this respect, of the theater of everyday life. In 1789, the sale of offices meant that the greatest social masquerade was the very idea of a feudal nobility whose virtues were passed on through the blood. You know the figures. That is, on the eve of the revolution, two-thirds of all noble families had bought their status in the last 200 years. Guy Chassinon Nougaret writes in 1789, the nobleman was nothing more than a bourgeois who had succeeded. The early revolution's sentimentalism, its tearful calls for openness, the later revolution's punitive vigilance and fear of conspiracy were a rejection of pre-revolutionary life as theater. But examples of willed mutual delusion still had their place. In truth, there is but one order, and that is the nobility. It is a separate people, a false people, who, for lack of any useful attribute, can only live as vegetative excrescences, as leeches on the lifeblood of plants until they enfeeble and deplete them. The Abbé Sieyès and other revolutionaries had good reasons for casting the nobility as a singular and separate people. And so have, for that matter, generations of historians. Thank you.